My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the South Dixie Group of Alcoholics Anonymous from Miami, Florida, and I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since January 25th, 1981. And I'm grateful for that. I've met so many wonderful people, and I'm almost scared to like name them. Like John is over there, and I just met Brent and Adrian and Glenn, and you know I'm going to forget somebody. And Jack and his lovely wife Leslie and Don and Shelley and. Well, this will take an hour and a half just to introduce all the wonderful people. And that's what I love doing. I love meeting people. Kevin last night asked me, he says, well, do you like traveling around and doing this stuff? I said, no. I said, I don't. But I love when I get there meeting the people. That's what I love. I love meeting people in AA and talking to people in AA. And he said, do you plan these talks? I said, you're going to figure out once I get up that I don't plan them. And it's about this time that I sort of start thinking, gee, I wish I had planned what I was going to say. And they said, some guy asked me, do you get nervous? I said, I really don't. And I said, and that's not because there's anything special with me, because I used to get nervous, and it's not unusual to get nervous. I've been doing this for a long time, but that has something to do with faith. And because I actually, the stronger my faith is, the less I trust in myself. You know, when you have to trust in yourself, you got to plan and write things down and take notes and all sorts of stuff. And what happens is it stops you from being authentic, and it scripts you, and it stops you from being authentic, because as I'm walking in here, I may actually, because I'm an alcoholic and I'd like to think I live a spiritual life now, I might bump into somebody and have a 5-minute conversation with them, and as a result of that conversation, it may have spiritual components to it, that I may want to talk about that conversation, but I won't be open to the spiritual aspects of that conversation because I'm so locked into worrying about whether I'm going to follow the script or not. And as a matter of fact, something like that happened tonight. I was sharing with Brent about something that happened to me about an hour and a half ago that I'm actually going to share with you because I think it's an important basis in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to be talking tomorrow on one of my favorite topics, emotional sobriety and spiritual sobriety. I am old school. I mean, I'm very old school. I'm 1935 to 1939 old school. And, that's the old school where they said the books that we found absolutely essential were 1 Corinthians 13, Sermon on the Mount, and the Book of James. I mean, we're talking about real old school stuff. And I'm not going to go into that. I'm going to talk a little bit about that more and how it's changed me and helped me in my sobriety tomorrow. But I'll probably mention a little bit about that. But, about 2 nights ago, I got on a plane on Wednesday. We've been planning for months to come here. And I got on a plane on Wednesday to, that was the deal, Wednesday at around, I don't know, 1 o'clock. We had to be there at 11 o'clock. And Tuesday night at 11 o'clock, I was on the phone with my doctor who was going to put me in the emergency room because I was very, very ill. And, to be looking forward to this and planning for this, in Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, the part about Bill Dodson, that's the man on the bed. You know, they have that picture of the man on the bed. A lot of people think it's called the man on the bed. It's actually called Came to Believe. And that's Bill Wilson. Dr. Bob's there. They got the Bible open. They're talking to him. And he was the guy who was the real corker. And one of the things he says there in talking about his sobriety is he said, I knew there was something. He was sober. I mean, let me tell you something. I play golf, you know what I mean? And I have good golf clubs and all that sort of stuff. I'm not a good player, but, and I play on Doral country, and there are who's that? And Tiger Woods plays golf. And he uses probably the same clubs I use, but let me explain something to you. There's no question about it, we're playing a different game. And I was in AA for a long period of time where I didn't realize that there were men playing a different game. That I was sober and they were sober, we were playing a different game. I went to a meeting where there was a guy named Al Kennedy speaking. And he was about, my age now, I'm 68, and he was up there talking, and he was just, you're one of these people, you know, you meet these people in AA where they sort of like uplift you. You just feel better being in their presence, you know. You just feel like you're involved in something that's so much more important than there's something about them. And he was doing that and talking about himself, and he was, one of the things I liked about it is he was so, he was like wearing life like a loose garment. He was so authentic. And he wasn't, it was almost like you were in his living room. I mean, like 100, 200 people there, and he was just talking like, you know, like a regular person. And I was sitting there, and just, I was sitting in the front row looking at him. And then he left, and I turned to my sponsor. I said, Al Kennedy, I said, you know, that guy, and I was 3 months sober, and I said, you know, that guy, he was really something, because I wanted to hang around him. You know, I always thought this was sort of like a program of osmosis. You really didn't have to do anything. Just hang around him, you know, and he'll sort of slough off on you. And which is, quite frank, I learned that wasn't true, and then I learned it was true. I learned it wasn't true, you had to do the work, and then I learned after that, it's probably good to hang out with somebody that's got a little bit ahead of you and, you know, try to just watch them and listen to them. And when he was done, I turned to my sponsor and I said to him, and I said, man, that guy was something. You know, I really liked him. He said this, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about my sponsor during this talk. Because I unfortunately was terribly undersponsored, and I was abused as a sponsee, and abused children become abusers. So you know, I said, you know, he was always saying, unfortunately, you got to understand the way I talk is I'll take these hard rights and lefts, and I'll say, when's he going to get back to the point? And I, you know, let me tell you, I'll put it this way: when I was 1 month sober, I'm married to my lovely wife who's there. My lovely wife, Dickie. I was married, and I was like 3 months behind in the mortgage, and you know, two or three kids or something like that. And I'm sitting there dying, and I need money, and I go up to my sponsor on Friday night, and I said my life is over. I'm gonna be kicked out on the street. I need money. What's gonna happen? I mean, money's not important. It's just right up there with oxygen, you know. And I'm just going, I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And he's my sponsor, so he's gonna probably write me a check for $5,000 or something, whatever the heck they're supposed to do. And after I'm done whining and crying and repeating myself at night times, he says, you know, Russ, I think it's about time you started making coffee for the group. I started getting the feeling that there wasn't a conversation going on. He was understanding me. And he marched me over to the coffee thing, and he started showing me how to make the coffee, and I'm making the coffee, and I start making the coffee. And, you know, the next night I was depressed. I didn't want to go, but I had to go because I had to make the coffee, and I had to go there and make the coffee. I have no idea what happened. The money thing cleared up. I wasn't, you know, the thing didn't happen. I kept on coming to the group. 3 months later, some guy comes up, and he says, I'll make the coffee. He said, I'm the coffee maker of this group. So you guys, that's my sponsor. My sponsor is the guy who signed my, I graduated with Departmental Honors in Mathematics, it's a National Science Foundation Fellowship. You know, I was going for my PhD in algebraic topology. You know, I'm not a dumb guy. I ultimately went to law school. I'll tell you the whole story when I get into my story. And my sponsor didn't even graduate sixth grade. And I was supposed to be sponsored by Albert Einstein or Jesus or both of them. And they weren't around. And they give me this guy who's a used car salesman. And he's sitting in front of me in my office, which is a wall about this size, which has about 100 different degrees that basically attest to how I've been educated far beyond my capacity to understand anything. And I turned to my sponsor and I said, Bob, these are my degrees. And he said, well, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees. You know what they do with those. So when I talk about my sponsor, Bob, I want you to understand this is the kind of person I'm talking to. So Al Kennedy had just gotten up there to speak, and he said, I said to him, that guy was great and, you know, fantastic. So, you know, and so he turns to me, he says, yeah, you know, he's dying. I said, no, because I figured he didn't hear me. So it's like one of these, when I'm having a conversation, I said, no, I'm talking about the guy who just spoke. He says, yeah, he's dying. I said, what do you mean dying? He's dying. He says, yeah, he's dying of cancer. He's got 6 months to live. I said, what do you mean he's dying of cancer? He didn't say anything about dying. He said, no, he's just talking to people. He's like uplifting people. He says, I know. He says, but he's dying of cancer. It's got 6 months to live. And 6 months later, Al Kennedy was dead. And you know what happened to me right then? Right then, my concept of what it meant to be sober changed. I mean, I'm going to tell you something. You don't make this crap up. I mean, I was there. I saw this. You know, I witnessed this deal. I mean, I'm the original thumb-sucking crybaby. I'm a self-pityaholic. You know, anything's going wrong is good for 17 meetings. Let me tell you about me. You know, and here's some guy dying, and he's doing a meeting. He doesn't even talk. If it was me, I would have said, well, it was nice talking to you. Well, I'm dying, but it was good to be here, you know. And I would have gotten something from it, you know, and so, you know, that's, you know, so, and so actually this gets, do you even remember the original story, the point I was making? No. So getting back to Bill Dodson. Bill Dodson said, and you start seeing that your own life starts modeling these old timers. Bill Dodson said, in watching people like Bill Wilson, who was his Al Kennedy, he says, I was sober, but he says, I knew there was something more, something I hadn't got, something a person ought to have. And I was trying to find the answer, because I was sober, but I was crazy. He doesn't say that. I added that, because I was sober and I was crazy. You know, you don't stay in AA for a long period of time. You're in AA for about 3 or 4 months, not drinking, and then you wake up one night at 3 o'clock in the morning and your mind's, you know, you got 18,000 voices with 15,000 things all about yourself and bad crap about other people, and now you're saying to yourself, now I know I drank. This is crappy. There ain't no fear like sober fear, you know. And he said, I knew there was something more, something I hadn't gotten. And he says, I was in my kitchen, and Bill was talking to my wife, Henrietta, and I heard him say this. This is what it says. And you ought to check this out. Read this story tonight if you're there. He said, Henrietta, this is the line. He said, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I got to keep talking about it and telling other people. And he said, something snapped in him right there, just like with me and Al Kennedy. He said, I knew that was the answer. Bill was very, very grateful for the blessings of his sobriety, and he gave all credit to God. And he was so grateful to God for everything that he's given to him that he had to tell other people about it. And so on Tuesday night before I came here, at 11 o'clock, my doctors told me I have to go to the emergency room. And I was looking forward, I'm always looking forward to be able to tell what God's done for me in my life. You know, in order to try to help other people, in order to try to honor him. And I'm thinking now I got to go to the emergency room and I'm not going to be able to make it, which is like an impossible, it's like a horrible deal for me. I mean, for 3 months and I want to make it and I don't want to let anybody down. And it's that kind of deal. And I started praying like a son of a gun. I mean, I pray like a son of a gun anyway, but it was like praying to the power of 10 for God to help me. You know, sometimes when obstacles are put in your life and you're an alcoholic, you can discern them, and it may take a long time to get this, the power of the discernment. You may have to talk to a sponsor a lot of times, as God trying to stop you from doing stupid stuff. And you sort of back up, and you know, you're making the phone call, it's busy, you're angry because you're gonna explain to what, and you're gonna say, maybe I shouldn't be making this phone call. And sometimes there's obstacles in your life, and it maybe takes a spiritual man or woman to understand this, and you understand what the obstacles are, as it's an evil force trying to stop you from doing something you need to do. And sometimes it's hard to discern what the deal is. You know, that's part of the serenity prayer, to discern the difference. And I discerned it, and I've got to tell you something, the way I discerned it is as something that I needed to do to come here to fulfill a responsibility and to talk about my life and what God had done for me in my life, and some evil force trying to stop me, you know, from doing something that's important. And I prayed about it, and I'm here today. Because once again, as he's done many times, the Lord came through for me. And so I wanted, so in any event, so I'm lying in bed, because I wanted to get a little sleep or a little nap or something like that before I came down here. And it was like 5:30 or so, and I'm about 4:30, and I'm lying down, and I just start going to sleep, and all of a sudden the phone rings. And I pick up the phone, my cell phone, and I pick it up, and I said hello, and he said Russell, and I said yeah, he says it's Travis, and I said Travis, I look at my phone and I see his last name, and I besides the fact that I was just woken up, and I get phone calls from all over, you know, like from New York and London and all that, you know, stuff, you know, people that maybe heard the tapes or something like that, and my sponsees and other people, and I'm saying, yeah, Travis, and I know the people and I know the names, and but sometimes I need to be reminded, you know. I mean, who's this? It's Joe, who, you know. I got a call from one guy, aren't alcoholics great? I get a call from a guy named Joe. I am doing it again, I know, but I can't help it. I get a call from a guy named Joe, and he's from Texas, and he says, Russell. I said, yeah. He says, it's Joe. I said, Joe. I said, a guy I used to sponsor, you know, like 14 or 15 years prior to that. I said, it's Joe. I said, Joe. He says, Joe. He says, Joe. I said, Monkey Joe. I said, Monkey, how are you? He says, fine. I said, it's great to hear from you. Where are you? He says, I'm in Texas. He says, well, that's great. How are you doing, Monkey? He says, I'm fine. I said, hey, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. He says, so he starts telling me this question, this convoluted alky question, you know, he's in love with a girl and she's a heroin addict and he just goes through this whole long thing. And I said, and after I listened to it, I say, well, you know, Joe, I said, it's an interesting question, but, you know, I really think that, you know, I'm thinking this is really the kind of thing you need to share with your sponsor. And he says, well, what do you think I'm doing? I said, Joe, I haven't spoken to you in 14 years. And he says, well, this is the first time I've had a problem. How can you not be involved in this fellowship? So what was I talking about? Oh, yeah, Travis. Okay. So usually I have a bookmarker, you know, somebody who's supposed to be, you know, somebody's going to be my, I ought to make Jack my bookmarker, you know. I say, you know, so I can turn to him and say, what was I talking about? And so Travis calls me up and he says, so I wake up, he says, Travis from, and he comes from a city in Ohio, I think it's Ohio, that I can't even pronounce the name, from so-and-so, you know. And I said, yeah, Travis, how you doing, buddy? He says, how you doing? I says, well, I'm... He says, I said, well, you know, I'm in, and I didn't know where I was. I said, where am I? I think I'm in Colorado. Yeah. Where am I? I'm in Banff, Canada, and in about an hour, I'm going to go speak at a convention. And so I was just sleeping, and it sort of woke me up, and I was just trying to take a nap. And of course, without skipping a beat, he says, oh, hey, that's great. He says, listen, I want to talk to you about something. I got to tell you something about what's happening to me, you know. And because this is Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. We're not talking Well People's Anonymous here, you know. And I'm sort of used to this at this point, you know. So he goes, let me tell you what's happening to me. And I said, okay, not like, you know, well, would you like to go back to sleep or, you know, do you have time? Do you have time to talk? I'm loving it, though. You know, I'm loving the guy. He says, sure, tell me. And he said, you know, he says, I'm sure he won't mind me telling me this. And if he does, it won't matter anyway. It's too late. Yeah. You know, listen, I'm telling you, it's you know. But I think it's a great story because I think it's a wonderful story. And I think the Lord, I got to tell you something. I think the call was made so I can tell you guys the story. And that's why I think the call was made. He probably doesn't realize that, but that's the deal. I've made that call. I'm making that call. They can't fire you from Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I learned that at 25 years. I used to worry about, I'd quote scripture, talk about Jesus. I'd say all sorts of stuff and say crazy stuff. And I'd say, somewhere around 25 years when I started being, I lost, what is that? You lose the fear of people and recognize insecurity, which I'm going to talk about tomorrow. The bottom line is I started realizing, I said, wait a second, I don't think they can fire me from this organization. You know what I mean? I can say whatever I want to do. They just, you know, they'll just stop inviting me. And so I say all this crazy stuff that probably violates every tradition in the group, and I just get more invitations to speak. And I don't know. Because apparently people want to hear it. I don't know what that's all about. Because so in any event, so he said, you know, I had this, I was off this job where I was making a lot more money. And I was praying about it. And then I looked at my two little kids and I felt I had to ask them what they wanted me to do, and it would involve a lot of traveling away from them. They said, Daddy, stay home. And so I made the decision to stay home. I said, I think I'm glad you talked to your kids instead of figuring it out on your own. And he said, and then, you know, a job opened up at work, and I was supposed to get the job, and it was a lot more money, and they gave it to somebody else. And I got to tell you something, I had a sort of resentment about that. And he said, but then I figured, you know, that maybe God has something better planned for me. I said, and he says, down the road, he has some better plan for me. And I said, and then I'll receive something even greater, a greater sort of thing, a greater deal. And I said, Trav, you've already received it. He said, I said, yeah. He says, listen, Travis, God's going to give you the better job, and you're going to do better, and you're going to get the material things. I said, but if you read the sixth step, what he's really interested in is character building. He's interested in separating you out, you know, the men from the boys, the Al Kennedys. He's interested in growing the Al Kennedys. He's interested in you growing in his likeness and image. And he said, and so that's what he's interested in, men of character. And you see, you've already, and he does that by putting us through these trials. That's all, what the book of James is all about. All through these things that we go through, and you've already instantaneously received exactly what you're supposed to receive as far as character building, just in the way you handled both situations by turning to God and making him the central fact of your life. Which, if you remember, that's, they talk about the great fact is the way we get rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence and experiencing much of heaven, because a lot of people get sober, not too many people get that deal going on, is by making God the central. We become to realize that he's the central factor of our lives, and we become absolutely certain that he is doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. And he says the fact that you have come to a place, even moments after it happened, that you realize that this is some sort of a God thing, and you're going to get something down the road, your brain is already being transformed to think about spiritual things instead of think about the material things. And so you've already received the gift, and you're receiving the gift right now. And I'm glad he called. I'm glad I was able to tell him that, and we were able to share that, and I was able to tell him that I'm so proud of him for that deal, and I'm glad I was able to share it with you. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story now, and you know, one of the things that happens is, you know, when you come into alcohol, I've been sober for 36 years, you know, no big deal. My sponsor's got like 62 years. But, you know, what happens is a lot of this stuff, don't you? You know, I know a lot of you guys have a lot of years, you know, a lot of stuff you sort of learn. I've connected a lot of dots in 36 years. You go through a lot of pain, a lot of struggling, a lot of things, and then all of a sudden you look back and you see how one thing leads to the other thing, how the third step ties into the seventh step, how the seventh step ties into the second step. You just sort of, and you start putting things together, you connect dots and everything like that, and all of a sudden things start clearing up. And what happens is, it says our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like. And I come in here not having a clue as to what my story is. I walk in here at 31, I don't have a clue as to who I am. You know what my story is at 31 years old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous? It's her fault. It's his fault. I'm not to blame. Some other guy did it, you know. I'm a lawyer. That's like they come into my office that way, you know, with this unbelievable chain of events with results in their indictment, you know, and they say, well, it's not my fault, it's his fault, it's their fault. I have a sign on my desk, you know, that I showed to him. It's from Jack Nicklaus, A Few Good Men. He says, the truth, you can't handle the truth. And I know that if I don't get this guy to at least go down from his planet to the planet Earth to see where he plays a part of it, the judge is going to put him under the jail, you know? But I walked in here. That's how we walk in here. I'm not to blame. It's not my fault. I wouldn't have done it if they didn't do it to me and everything. I have no idea what my story is or what part I paid or who I am. And what happens is, as I go along, I listen to people in AA. And you know how well defended we are and how obnoxious and how know-it-all, and we're all brilliant and, you know, and you can't tell me. Who do you think you are? You know, you take your own inventory. You can't tell me what to do. You don't know me, you know what I mean? No, actually, I know you better than you know yourself. But, you know, and we come in here with all these attitudes and everything, and we got to come at it. You can't confront, unless you're somebody like my sponsor, you got a sponsor who's going to confront you. You can't come at them head first because they'll tell you to go to hell and forget about it. And we come at them sideways. Hey, it comes at you sideways. By lying to you, you know? They lie to you, say, oh, don't worry, it's not about God, and it's all about God, you know? And they just tell you stuff. They bait and switch you, you know? And you're sitting in an A room, and somebody gets up and tells it and says something. Some guy gets up and talks about something that happened to him, and you're in the back of the room and says, oh, man, that guy is crazy. And then all of a sudden, a little voice says, holy crap, I was thinking that last week, you know what I mean? And, you know, and by listening to people and everything like that, you start realizing how nuts you are. And say, yeah, that was my story. That's what happened to me. And then all of a sudden, you start realizing stories that happened to you even before you started drinking by hearing other people. And then you start realizing stories that happened to you while you were drinking. And all of a sudden, 3, 6, 9 months, 2 years, 5 years down the road, all of a sudden, you've got a story. You got a story. It's the greatest of the world. You know something. You see something about who you are. And then as you go on, and now you got 5 years, and now you got 70 more stories. Mm-hmm. And you got 10 years, you got 116 stories. And then you got 36 years, and you got 300 stories. You know, and they're all like gifts from God that tell you a little bit about who you are and what you are and where you fit and everything like that. And you say things like, you see, and all of a sudden you see, you look at the stories that you had before you started drinking. Then you look at the stories that you had while you were drinking. And you look at the stories that you had and you went through with all the fears and all the anxieties after you stopped drinking. And you realize it's the same story. That whatever the story is about alcoholism and about your life and who you are, what your problems were, haven't changed from the day you were spermed or born or whatever it is from you came out. That I've been an alcoholic ever since I was like 1 month old up until the moment right now. I used to be an alcoholic that didn't drink at first with fears and anxieties. And then I was an alcoholic who drank. And now I'm an alcoholic who doesn't drink. And you start realizing that the alcohol really is a symptom. The drinking really is a symptom. The disease centers in my mind, not my body. It's a spiritual disease and changes based upon a spiritual program of action. And so, but this doesn't come apparent to you. It takes a long time to go from your head to your heart until you start developing these stories and you see it for yourself. And sometimes one of the problems is, you know, I only have 3 hours tonight, right? So when we get sober, we get real mindful of time, you know? And get real worried about that. Oh, I think this son of a bitch is going over, you know what I mean? And that never was a problem for me when I was drinking. But in any event, I could spend 12 hours in a bar easy. So so what happens is you develop all these stories and you get up there and they say, okay, tell us your story in 45 minutes, you know? And you got 300 stories, and which ones do you tell? You know, it's like your babies, you know? And you tell these four stories and you walk up and says, man, I wish I told them this story. And then, you know, you feel like you left one of your kids, you know, in New York or something, you know? And that kind of thing. I picked out about two or three stories that I'm telling you because I think a good AA talk, one of the things I do in South Florida that I used to think was all over the world is something called Step Series. And what will happen is a group of people will ask you to, you know, certain people to give a series of 12 talks over a period of 3 months from steps 1 through 12. So I would get an opportunity, let's say, to talk to a particular group of people, usually the same group, for 12 hours of talks. And you're during that period of time, you pretty much scrunch down, it's almost like a college course, all about your sobriety and what's going on, and they're able to know you, and you're able to know them, and you understand that, and that kind of deal. But obviously, in a 45-minute talk, you can't do something like that. But in any event, I do think a good AA talk has to do about being authentic and talking about my story, and also being mindful of the literature, which I'm a student of. And in any event, so one of the first things I remember is I was down in being like 8 or 9 or 10 years old in Great Neck, New York, and you know, when you're a young kid, the only thing that's important is like sports, and I was always lousy at sports. And I remember being down on a football field, and they would be choosing up sides, or a baseball field, and they're the two captains. You know, they're like the guys. You know, I love Jack. I met him last night. He's fantastic. You know, he's an Al-Anon. You know, I'll tell you what, but I'm making him officially an AA, because as far as I'm concerned, he's great. He, my wife, she's wonderful. She's an Al-Anon, too. Our Ladies of Perpetual Revenge, you know what I mean? But, now, she does a great Al-Anon 10th step. When I'm wrong, she probably admits it, you know? And she had one of my grandchildren. I got 4 kids and 6 grandkids, one on the way, 2, 7. And my smallest one is Andrea. And so I'm in my home office and I'm working or something. Andrea, and she's about a foot and a half or however, and she's cute as a button. She comes up and he says, Grandpa. I said, yeah. He says, what kind of fish are you? I said, I'm sorry, what? He says, what kind of fish are you? I said, I don't know, Andrea. What kind of fish am I? He says, you're a selfish. And my wife's like chuckling in the kitchen, you know, training them young and all that sort of stuff, you know. But in any event, so I'm down in the football field, and, you know, they got the two captains, you know, choosing up sides, and I'm like the geekiest guy there, and I can't catch anything. And what happens is, you're standing in the middle, and as they're choosing people, the thing's getting closer and closer together. And here's what I'm thinking. I'm praying. I'm saying, God, please don't let me be last. Please don't let me be last. I didn't want to be the one they hated the most. Because, you know, when you're last, and it seems like you're last, you know how they pick the last? They go, oh, man, do we got to take them? It's like they'd rather play with one less, and you're standing there all by yourself, and you're being and humiliating, and people are laughing at you. And it seems like if I was picked second last, which happened once in a while, it was like winning the Oscar. You know what I mean? It was the guy they hated more than worse. It seems like I was always picked last. When I was picked last, I said, I had this incredible feeling well up in me that I wanted everybody to die or something to happen or I wanted to cry. But here, an equal and opposite reaction welled up in me that I noticed. And it was almost natural. It was a natural thing that somehow, and I don't know where this came from, it's a fear that I knew if I let them know how I felt, something bad was going to happen. So what I did was I acted like it didn't bother me. I sort of acted like they were laughing at me, and I laughed too, like I was standing where they were. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I'm just telling you. I acted like it was no big deal when I wanted to commit suicide. Maybe one of the first times in my life I started acting differently than the way I felt. In sort of like a bad way, I think. For no reason other than it felt natural. Because I was going to put, by doing that, I knew I was putting some sort of protective wall between me and them. So they could never know what they were doing to me, and they could never hurt me. And by the time I was 18 years old, that wall was about 3 feet thick. And nobody was ever going to know what was going on inside of me. And the real problem was, I had no idea what was going on inside of me. I was just acting and reacting and doing and living, and that's the deal. And I met a gal. I went to college, and I met some gal, and I was in love with her, and it was true alky love. I was with her every single day, and if I wasn't with her, I was thinking about her, and thinking about what she's thinking, and thinking about who she's with, and what she's thinking about, and what's happening. It was true alky love. Well, I call it love. Some people call it stalking. It doesn't matter. But it was, and one day, and you know, they say we're selfish and self-centered. Now, I don't understand about that deal. So one day, we're every day, and she came from New Jersey, and her parents have been putting her through school. And one day, she comes to me, and she says, around Christmas time, and she says this. She says, the girl I loved, the woman I loved. And she says to me, my parents would like me to come home for Christmas, to spend Christmas with them, and without missing a beat, with as much hate, I can't tell you the hate and the anger that welled into me, I said these words, well, what about me? Because I can tell you, underneath every love, or underneath every caring, or under anything that, let me tell you something, if you scratch the surface, it was always, what about me? What's going to happen to me? You know, now I didn't know that had to do with selfishness or something. That's just the way I am. You know, my sponsor used to say, why do you do the things you do? Why do you say the things you say? Why do you think this? And I'd say, that's just my personality. And my sponsor, Bob, would say, he says, well, Russ, it's your personality that's killing you. Now I know how to stop the drinking. How do you, like, get that new person? How do you switch, like, personalities? You know what I mean? I've been me all my life. And besides, I sort of like my personality. Now, I like the personality that's driving me crazy and hurting other people. And, of course, she left for New York. And, of course, 2 days later, I followed her and knocked on her door. And she says, hi, it's me. I'm here from Miami, you know. And so when I was about 15, I discovered Playboy magazine. And I discovered what the answer to life was after I looked at Playboy magazine, and that's the deal. And I figured if I get one of them bunny things, I would be, if I get a gal that looked like that to love me and desire me, then my life, you know, because if you're an alcoholic, I'm constantly figuring out things that are going to make my life complete. and then running after them and getting them or not getting them or getting them, and my life is complete for a second, and then it's not good enough, you know? If only I had that job. If only I had that girl. I know exactly what the problem is. The problem is I don't have that gal. The problem is I need my old girlfriend back. The problem is I need my car. I need this. I need that. And I'm running after that, and I just knew that. I just know that that's the answer to my problem, and so I spent my whole life running after that stuff, and girls have been a big part of it, and there's a problem. Of course, there's a problem with that because I was scared of them, but I don't even know why I was scared of them. I was just scared of them. But you know what helped out with that? Colt 45 malt liquor helps that, you know? And man, I put Colt 45 malt liquor in me, and I become Brad Pitt, you know what I mean? And you're not actually supposed to laugh at that, but it's okay. I understand. I'm over that problem. Okay, so the bottom line is I so that's the deal. So I became chasing that stuff, and so when I was about 17 years old, I 17 or 18 or 19, I'm not sure. No, maybe about 19 or 20. They had the new Camaros that came down. I think it was 1970, the brand new Camaros, and they were absolutely gorgeous. And of course, if you need a car manager wrote a book called Man Against Himself, and he had a chapter on the book. This is 1939. A chapter in the book called on alcoholics. And he said alcohol, and it was in the chapter under the title Chronic Suicide. And he said alcoholics are men and women who are out to destroy themselves. And I ultimately learned after putting together a lot of stories that most alcoholics hate themselves and actually desire death. And that's why they're constantly doing things almost automatically that's going to put them in jams or kill them because we really hate ourselves, you know. And if, you know, I don't know, you're sitting in the shower and you're sober and you're lathering up and all of a sudden you hear this voice and it says, you're an idiot, you ought to kill yourself. You're never going to be okay, you're a flipping failure. And you turn around to see who's saying that stuff to you, and you be the only one in the shower. You got one voice telling you the greatest in the world and nobody understands you, and you should be the president and everybody should listen to you, and you got another voice that says somebody ought to blow your brains out. And you know, I don't know who understands. I don't know. Some guy told me, he says, I think you got a split personality. I said, I wish I could boil it down to two, you know, I'd be okay, you know. And I don't know, but that thing is real. And then you walk around and you know, you sit around spending your whole life worrying about what other people think about you. Your whole life worrying about other people thinking about you. You don't think you're doing that because you lie to yourself. You tell yourself lies because you rationalize. You tell yourself rational lies. You say things. I mean, if you're an alcoholic, you say things. You say like self-talk, like, well, "I don't give a crap what they think about me. I don't give a crap what they think about me." Sometimes you say it out loud. You say to your friend, "I don't give a crap what they think about me." But ultimately, you realize that people that say, "I don't give a crap what they think about me," all they do is think about what other people think about them. Because people who really don't give a crap what other people think about them never say, I don't give a crap what they think about. They say things like pass the ketchup, but they don't say that shit. You know what I mean? And so the I don't know. Yeah, you don't know what it's like. But so what was I talking about? I don't know. So I decide. So when you really have a deep-seated feeling of being unworthy, where you're not worthy to even be alive. And even when somebody says they love you, you don't feel worthy of their love. Because why would they love you if they only knew what a piece of crap you were? When you're unworthy, you've got to spend more money than you make. Money that you got to spend money you don't have to buy crap you don't need, to impress people you don't like, because by yourself you're a nothing. So you got to be, it's not just me, it's got to be me with a law degree. It's got to be me with a new car. It's got to be me with money. It's got to be me with whatever. You're constantly, and it's very costly, running after stuff to try to add accoutrements to you to make you acceptable, because you're not acceptable. And you don't even know you're doing it. All you know is you need, you want, you have to have, or else your life will not be okay. You need a better house or a better, or this, that, and the other thing. And it's a horrible existence. And it's all about, you know what it's all about? It's all about the real alcoholism. That's the real deal you struggle with. You can overcome the drinking. How do you overcome that thinking? You can overcome the drinking and the thinking. And so I ran down. These new Camaros came in, and I knew if I could get one of them Camaros, that would be it, man. I'd have the bunny. I ran down, I had inherited some money, you know, I spent it all, put it down, I still owed like 3 years or whatever, you know, whatever the deal it is. And I said, okay, give me the car. He said, no, we can't give it to you. He said, what do you mean? He says, well, we got to prep it. I said, no, I'll take it right now. You know, because if you're an alcoholic, you need it now, you know what I mean? I need to get that I need to get that blouse now. You know, I need to lose weight now. I need to do this now. Everything is vanity, vanity, and Ecclesiastes, all is vanity, everything. I need all this stuff to make me better now. I can't wait. Because don't you understand, I'm a piece of crap. I need to get better. I need it now. And they said, look, we can't give it to you, but if you show up tomorrow morning, we'll give it to you. And the next morning, I was there at 8 o'clock, 8:30 in the morning, and they rolled it out around 9:30, and there it was, and I was in that brand new, it had like 100 miles. It was gold with a white vinyl top, kind of cheesy now, but it was pretty cool back then. And I was there, and I don't know, I was like 18, 19 years old, and I was like 150 pounds lighter, you know, and I was wearing my sunglasses, I was in my t-shirt, I was like buff, you know, I used to work out, and you know, I was smoking a cigarette, you know, and I mean, I was like James Dean, you know, and I was in that car and I had the windows rolled down. I was driving down Miami Beach. I was just waiting for the world to discover me. I was like driving down Alton Road. I thought I was driving in Yankee Stadium. I thought every woman in China was looking at me. I was waiting to be discovered. I'm all right now. And I pull up to the first light and I'm sitting there and some guy pulls up to my right in a brand new Cadillac, brand new red Cadillac. Some old fart, you know, probably my age, you know what I mean? I'm like 18, 19, he's like 60, you know, and you know, and I'm looking at him, I'm looking up at him, he's looking down at me. I'm looking up at him, he's looking down at me. I'm looking up at him, he's looking down at me. I look up at him and sitting next to him is the bunny. You don't know what it's like, Jack, you know. And you know what I think? First thought goes to my mind, why can't I have a Cadillac? Why can't I have a car like that? I mean, the feeling lasted 3 blocks, you know what I mean? The payments lasted 36 months, you know? And it kept me coming back for more, to get that thing so that I would be okay, to get something that so I would be okay. Then I went to college and I met this gal. And I looked at her, and her father was a doctor, her mother was a lawyer, she was good. I said, man, if I could only get that one, if I could marry her, everything would be perfect. And I'm a true alcoholic, you know. I set my sights, you know. I wanted what she had. I was willing to go to England to get it. And I set my sights, and I went and I got it. Next thing, we were married at Westview Country Club, big wedding, whole bit. We had a child, graduated law school, went to work for the DA's office, became a division chief, trying major crimes there, you know, the Jan Arena, and had a house on Miami Beach on Alton Road, beautiful son. And I don't know how long... And I was great. Everything was great for about a year. And then all of a sudden I started hanging out more and more in the bars, and she'd be at home cooking and waiting for the kids, and I'd be saying, I'll be home, and you know, any second, I'll be home. And I'd roll in at 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And now, I never cheated on my wife. I never cheated on her. I just sat in the bar and thought about cheating on her a lot. Because now I realize, after a few years and a few more stories, that, see, you know, I, as a true alcoholic, I'm thinking, well, you know, this marriage isn't working, you know, we're not the right people, maybe we got married too young, but, you know, the truth is, she had pretty much become the Camaro, and there were Cadillacs on that dance floor. And, you know, she got married because she believed in, you know, holy matrimony, and she believed in integrity and giving an oath and everything like that. And I just wanted to get laid. That's pretty much it. Male whore, you know? And I tell you this stuff because, you know, I know here we're supposed to yuck and laugh a lot about it, because I don't want to pretend that I'm a nice guy. You know, I used to do that for years. Well, I'm not as bad as Adolf Hitler, you know? I'm not as bad as Jack. Well, I haven't murdered anybody. But I'm not a nice guy. I know exactly what I am. And it's good to know who you are, because if you know who you are, then once God gets a hold of you and changes you to who you could be, you know what you should be grateful for. You never want to forget where you came from. You may never want to pretend that you're really a nice guy with a little bit of a drinking problem. Okay? So she told me one morning, you know, we have a line, it says, A lesson until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious, and if true happiness will find none at all. And what I had to learn is over a period of many years, there's a lot of consequences to being an alcoholic that have really nothing to do with drinking alcohol. And a lot of consequences. I'm a self-pity-aholic. There's a lot. I'm a please-don't-reject-me-aholic, please-love-me-aholic. You know, there's a lot of aholic stuff going on. And believe me, there's a lot of addictions going on that are much harder to break and much harder to see, and we're in denial of, that has to do with everything in this flipping world. Bill Wilson called them worldly clamors. Talk a little bit more about that tomorrow, you know, because I was addicted to a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of stuff. In a book where it talks about in the sixth step, that in the seventh step about you know, money, power, and romance. We don't want to put that down, but here comes the bait and switch. But nobody has handled it worse than us. In a book that says, see to it your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. Your real reliance must always be on God and focusing on him. Speaking to a group of people that would really not hear about it because they feel uncomfortable with the actual cure. You know, they just want to do it only so much as they'll settle for only so much that they're comfortable with without having to give up. And, you know, you just can't. You can't do the God and mammon thing. I've tried it. I tried it for many years. You can't do the, I love you, God. I want to be like God, but, you know, I'd really like to have that Cadillac. Love you, God, but I'd really like to have that gal over there. Love you, God. You know, it's got to, you know, you got to make a choice somewhere along the line. Or I'll tell you something. Man who stands in the middle gets hit by both sides. And so one day she came to me, and it was a Friday. Apparently she had some self-esteem. She came to me, she said, I just want you to know this. She said, I have this beautiful house in Miami Beach. She said, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. 12 words. If you come home drunk one more time, I am leaving you. 12 words. There's no fat in there. There's no, that's not like a lot. It wasn't like they were just trying to start a fight. You know what I mean? It was like, she's like delivering the mail. I just want you to know, you come home drunk, I'm just not going to do it anymore. I've been married 5 years, putting up with this stuff. You come home drunk one more time. I got in my car. I was as sober as I am right now physically. Sober as I am right now physically. I don't know how old I was, 25, 26, 27. You know, I got in my car. I drove 3 blocks. And I stopped at a light. And this is what I thought. This is what I said to myself. And this is a guy with all those degrees and everything. I say to myself this. I said, wonder what the hell she meant by that. Because one of the consequences of being an alcoholic is when you have you hear, see, read, or you're told something you don't like, it confuses you. It's confusing, you know? I walk in the court and the judge says, I see you one more time, you're going under the jail. And the guy walks out and says, what did I do? He says, what's he talking about, you know? I mean, it's like we just don't hear it. Or we hate the person. Or who the hell you think you are, or whatever it is. And I didn't understand it. And that night, I went to the bar. My friend Doug was there. I didn't forget it. I announced it. I said, I got to get him. Ronnie says, come on, drunk one time. She's leaving. Oh, she's not going to. He put his arm around me. She's never going to leave you. You're a great guy. She loves you, Russ. And I'm thinking, that's why I love this bar. That's why I love these guys. They are so right. That's exactly what I'm thinking, you know? And so I it was 4:30 in the afternoon. You know what I mean? My house is only 50 minutes away. I had time for like one drink. So I had one drink, a double scotch. You know what I mean? I was already on two before I knew it, but I was double scotch, you know? And I was a fast drinker. I was like, whack, you know? Because I drank, believe me, I drank for the effect. I wanted to get that spot. I wanted to get that spot where I really didn't give a crap what other people thought about me, which is what alcohol do for you for a while. And I went whack, and now it's 4:30 and 30 seconds. And apparently I'd already crossed over that line. You know, maybe a week before I could have made it home, but I'd already crossed over that line where once I took everything that was important to me or should have been important to me was right up there on the line, and all I had to do was get home sober. And I took a whack, and it was 4:30 and 30 seconds, and it seemed I had time for another drink, and I had another drink. The next thing I know, it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and they were pouring me into my living room. And the next morning, I was out of my house, and that was the end of a 5-year marriage. And I'm walking to my car away from my wife and my kid. I'm saying, this is what I'm saying. I'm free. I'm free. You know, all those girls I've been dreaming about in the bars, all that life I was dreaming about, you know, I'm free. Free to go to the bar. I was never free not to go to the bar, you know, and I'm free. And of course, and my former wife, you know, after about a month of this and going through the divorce thing, we you know, she said, I want to try to, what do they call it? reconcile. And that means like getting back together again. And so because let's face it, quite frankly, I felt guilty because, as my sponsor said, I was guilty. I went to the, I said, I feel guilty. He says, that's because you are guilty. He says, so I went to the guy in the marriage counselor. The marriage counselor says one of these things. He says, Ronnie, what are the three things you want to change about Russell? I guess they teach this in marriage counseling. He says, well, I think she probably said something about drinking. She said something, I wasn't paying attention, because I'm sitting there thinking, I'm already making my moves to be the Hugh Hefner of Miami. I'm already doing my thing, you know what I mean? And all I'm thinking is they're putting me back in the cage, they're putting me back in the box, you know, and I shouldn't belong there. And at the end of this, it's going to be a bad deal. And then he turns to me and he says, so Russ, what are the three things you want to change about Ronnie? And I go, I just want to date other women. And that was the end of the session. That was it. I sabotaged it. And I wanted to tell you that because you wanted somebody. I was 10 years sober. This is the truth. I don't know why this didn't come out in the first four step. I've made amends to my former wife, but I was 10 years sober before I even thought about that story and what that must have done to her heart hearing that. Now, you may say, how could a person say that, things like that, and not understand how they're hurting other people? But you see, if you're an alcoholic, you probably don't have the bad strain of alcoholism I do. Because when you're an alcoholic, you say stuff to crush people's hearts, and you don't even recognize it. And if it's brought to your attention, you blow it away or get mad at the person who brings it to your attention. Because you are so self-involved in yourself and care only about yourself and nobody else. It's like simple. Because you know what that is? That's the dis-ease of alcoholism. And you know something, I don't need alcohol to be an idiot or to hurt people. I wish I could say alcohol did it for me. Oh boy, I wish I could say that, you know. Oh, if it wasn't for the alcoholism. Listen, I've hurt many people the same way I used to hurt them drinking. I still hurt them. I hurt them in AA the same way I used to hurt them. You know what I mean? I don't need alcohol. The only thing alcohol helped me do is live with my sorry ass self while I was doing it. And so then I finally got sober. I don't know how much time I have. I don't want to take more than 2 or 3 hours more, but I got about 2 more or 3 more stories I'm going to tell you, and then we're out of here. And I'm going to skip over a lot of the sponsor stories. And I got sober, came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and the night, I will tell you about the night I got, so what happened was I got a bachelor pad, and I started doing the thing, and I started drinking, and it got to the end of the road. My bottom, my actual spiritual bottom happened December 25th, 19, in December. My drinking got worse and worse and worse. It was like going like this, you know, so downhill at like a 45 degree angle, and all of a sudden it took a nosedive. You know, I mean, each month that went by, I was drinking more and feeling, and I was a self-pityaholic. I had stopped going to the bars. I used to be a bar drinker, and I had stopped going to the bars. And I felt lonelier in the bars surrounded by people than in my apartment where I could make up my imaginary crew, you know what I mean? And I would go down and I'd get up and I'd say, I'm not going to drink today. And by 5 o'clock, I was getting drunk. I'd get up, I'm not going to buy booze today. And by 5 o'clock, I'm searching for dimes, nickels, and quarters so I can purchase a bottle of, Carlos Rossi Cante and sit by the phonograph. Back then, we had LP records. Some of you guys don't know what those are. And I play my Alky songs. You know, believe me, I could do self-pity without music, but I'm really good at picking out good music to help me along with the self-pity. You know, it's songs like Only the Lonely, you know what I mean? Running on Empty, I'm Mr. Blue, Rainy Days and Mondays, anything by Karen Carpenter, you know what I mean? You know, any of that stuff, you know? And you know, I'm just sitting there drinking until, you know, fall, you know, And I was going too good, and then it was Christmas. We have a thing called Noche Buena, and I went out with a gal, my wife, my beautiful wife, who's been married to me for 36 years. Remember, she actually, I think, knew this gal, a gal named Daisy. I went out. She took me to a Noche Buena, which is the night before, and I got there drunk because I'm an alcoholic. I got there drunk, and her father said, "Get rid of this guy." And I was and next thing I know, it was like 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night, and I'm drunk, and I'm at my, and it's Christmas Eve, and I'm all alone, and you know, I mean, it's a lonely disease anyway, but what could be lonelier than alone on Christmas Eve when you know everybody in the world has somebody, and you're the only one who doesn't have anybody, and I'm alone, and it's now 11, it's 12 o'clock at night, and I turn on the TV, and you know, there's a preacher talking, And he's, you know, he's sort of like doing an AA thing. He's doing his testimony, and he's wondering, this is what was happening. This was going on in my life. You want to change your life and everything. And I was, and I'm telling you something, I was bankrupt. I was dead. I was spiritually dead. I was emotionally dead. I was bankrupt. I was 31 years old. I thought my life was, this is the truth. This is the actual words. I said, my life is over. I'll never be better again. I thought my life was over at 31. I'll never be better again. And the guy tells me, he gives me the invitation. He says, if you really want to change everything, get down on your knees, accept Jesus Christ. I got down on my knees, accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior, which is not a big deal for some of you guys, but for a Jewish kid from New York, let me tell you, it's major. Now, let me tell you, you know, you got to be real desperate. Telling me, you got to be real desperate. But you see, you know what I had? I didn't have much, but I'll tell you what, I had my desperation. And I did that. And for many years, I didn't think anything happened there. Because, you know, 15 guys didn't come in and drag me to an AA meeting, no white lights, I just went to sleep. But 30 days later, to the button, on January 25th, 1981, I had my last drink. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I picked up a white chip and never had necessary to find a drink after that. And what I know happened from actually reading the book, you know, after about 15 years, when I really wanted to get into the real deal, because I am like one of these guys, I'm between 1935 and 1939. When I started reading Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, you know, when they wrote the book, the Big Book was published in, A, started in 1935. Big Book was published in 1939. When they wrote in the Big Book, rarely have I seen a person fail who has thoroughly, painstakingly, thoroughly followed our path in 1939. A lot of people think that the path they were following must be what's going on today in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you want to know what they were doing, you need to read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Now be careful, you're going to read it like an alcoholic. You're going to say, I'm not doing that, I'm not going to do that, it ain't going to be that. No, that can't be that, they couldn't mean that, but that's what they were doing thoroughly. And what they were doing is you couldn't get into AA unless you got down on your knees and accepted the Lord. Or something. You can have your own opinion, but you can't have your own facts. I'm just telling you factually, when you want to know, when they were saying, rarely have I seen a person fail, has thoroughly followed a path, you didn't get, if you said, no, I'm not getting down on these, they had a nice life. Because here, back then, you had to prove to them that you were ready. Now in AA, we're begging them to come in. It was a different sort of dynamic going on. And they were serious as heart attacks. And when I read what they were doing to go in, I said, to get in, to be ready, to qualify. I said, wow, I did that. December 25th, Christmas Day, 1980. And in January, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I picked up a white chip. I'm going to tell you two stories, one fast, one a little bit longer, because that's it. Because then I'll start on more stories. It'll be crazy. Well, I do want to tell a story about Ray O'Keefe, another mentor that I had. I've had three sponsors because, unfortunately, all people say we've been my temporary sponsor. You can't make them permanent. You know, my sponsors, I have two beautiful sponsors. They died, and I've had just wonderful, wonderful sponsors. I was driving along with Ray O'Keefe once, who's a circuit speaker. He's got great tapes and everything. He's passed away. And I was about 9 years sober, and I was dogged with money, with worries about money. And I know I can look at this group, you guys don't have that problem, but I would have like anxiety about funds and money and everything like that. And quite frankly, 90% of the reason was not because I didn't earn money, it's just that I spent more money than I earned. And apparently when you do that, my second sponsor pointed out to me that when you spend more money than you earn, you go into something called debt. Now, I didn't understand that. You know, being departmental honors in mathematics, wasn't able to do that addition. But in any event, so I was saying to Ray O'Keefe, I said, now I'm 9 years sober. I'm working this thing like a son of a bitch. I'm doing a lot of service. I'm doing the whole deal. I said, when do I get the financial? Because I came in at 31. I'm a lawyer. I figured by 41, I'm a multimillionaire. And at 41, I'm still like worrying about stuff. I'm still like, money's an issue. So I said to Ray O'Keefe, I said, so when do I get financial security? And he said, what are you talking about? And he had about as much time then as, you know, like I have now. And I said, so what are you talking about? I said, financial security. It says in the promises, it says I have financial security. You know, I'm not worried about money anymore. I got money. I have financial. He said, what are you talking about, Russell? He says, in the promises, it says I'm going to have financial security. He says, it doesn't say that. I said, it does, right in the promises. He says, read it to me.
So I opened up the book. He's driving. I said, it says, fear of people and financial insecurity will leave you. He says, you see, the fear leaves you. He says, Russell, you will always be broke. It just won't bother you. I said, well, thanks for that, you know. So here's the last story. And this is a story that... And the reason I like to tell this story is because, you know, some people, I used to wonder, what's it like to be 36 years sober, working this program, and you still deal with alcoholism? I mean, how do you deal with alcoholism? It may not be so apparent, so I want to tell you what alcoholism looks like at 36 years sober, what it looks like to sort of break out into alcoholism, and what recovery looks like, because this is like a little something that truly happened to me. My wife, my lovely wife, who's fantastic, who I'm very lucky to have, I joke about her, I know. You know, the ladies of Progressive Revenge and all that stuff, but I love her very much. She's a great gal, and she's very helpful to me. She's a sweetheart, you know? And just for putting up with me, she should get like an award, you know what I mean? And she would like, from now on, whenever I talk, to have 15 minutes in rebuttal. But anyway, her birthday was August 6, 1953, this is just last August. So I said, "What do you want to do on your birthday?" And she was 45. Now the year before she was 40, but she's moved it up 5 years. You know what I mean? So. In any event, so she's decided she was 45. So she says, what do you want to do on your birthday? She says, well, we always do the same thing. She said, I want to go to a restaurant with all the kids and all the grandkids, you got to understand, I got 4 kids, I got 6 grandkids, I got brothers, son-in-laws and everything like that. So you're taking out like 14, 15, but whatever number, it's a large group of people. So I know I'm going to spend, you know, it's going to be serious bucks and everything. And we ain't going to Burger King. So I said, well, sure, absolutely. You know, pick out the... you know, I'm not a wealthy guy, but I'm not, you know, I'm not starving either, and I got plastic, and, you know, so, of course, they pick out, like, some restaurant, you know, something like Lay, it's going to cost you the rest of your life, shares. You know, not that I care about money or anything, but anyway, so they pick out this restaurant, and so we all go to the restaurant, all of us, the whole group goes to the restaurant, they give us a private room, and they start serving us, and I'm sitting there, and everybody's having a great time, you know what I mean, and I'm the only one that really doesn't drink, well, one of my son-in-laws doesn't drink, he's got about 10 years, he's doing great, and, you know, they're ordering, and it's not that I'm worried about money, but, you know, I just got to tell you, I don't know if this ever happened to you, in the back of my mind, I'm sort of like, I'm like a calculator. I'm like going, I don't know, 14 times 60, and I'm saying, and then my son, he says, bring us another bottle of that wine, you know what I mean? Oh, man, that's another 75, and yeah. And it's like sort of going on in the back of my mind, you know what I mean? And I'm sort of like adding up stuff in the back of my mind. You know, Andrea, remember Andrea? She says, Mommy, can I have a shrimp cocktail? Now, the shrimp are larger than Andrea. He says, can I have a shrimp cocktail? Sure, honey, Grandpa doesn't mind. They bring in the shrimp cocktail. She takes a little bite of one. She says, ooh, I can't stand that. He says, oh, man, that's $25. You know what I mean? Not that I'm bothered by it or anything, but I'm just thinking about it, you know? So we get through the meal. Everybody has a wonderful time. Nobody has any idea what I'm thinking. I don't even know what I'm thinking. I'm getting through it. They give me the plastic. That's the end of my life. I sign that away. And so we're driving. I'm going home with my wife and my middle daughter, Vanessa, who I love, is gorgeous. All my kids, they take after their mothers, gorgeous, and I'm driving them home, and I'm a coffeeaholic. The coffee was excellent. I'm a coffeeaholic, and I want the real deal. I want drugs in my coffee. You says, do you want decaf? No, put a lot of drugs in my coffee. What's that drug? Caffeine. Put it in. You know what I mean? So. It's like Ritalin. So I drink this stuff called Colombian, you know. Now, I'll tell you, ever since I've told this story, I get coffee from people. Some guy brought me coffee called Death Wish, you know. I drink this stuff called Folgers Colombian Blend, okay? It's like, you know, and so we're driving along, and I said, you know, honey, we're out of coffee. We've got to have coffee. And Vanessa says, Dad, stop by Publix. He says, I'll run in and I'll get you your coffee. I said, well, you did, really? I says, absolutely, Dad. So I pull up to Publix, and I say, now, Vanessa, it's Colombian. They have all this coffee, and they have, like, the breakfast crap. You know, they have, like, marks that like, the breakfast stuff is, like, yellow. But the Colombian is, like, dark brown. You know what I mean? It's like Colombian, Folgers Colombian coffee. He says, Dad, that's the third time you told me that. You say it one more time, I'm not getting you everything. She says, okay, no problem. I'm just telling you. She says, okay. She runs in, runs out. It's in the passenger. She throws in. She says, I got your coffee. She says, thank you very much. I drive her home. I drive her back to the house. I get back to the house. I open up. I take it out of the deal. And it's the Breakfast Club stuff. And like an explode. I mean, I'm sitting there. I'm saying, and I love my coffee, and I'm looking forward to my coffee. Not that I'm addicted or anything, but I'm looking forward to my coffee. And I said, and I'm trying to understand this. I said, I go through this entire night, you know what I mean? And all I'm doing is trying to, you know, I'm like the wallet, you know what I mean? And I want to help other people, and I want my wife to have a great birthday, and I do everything, and I ask for one lousy thing, you know what I mean? One lousy thing. One lousy thing. I mean, am I crazy? And I even repeat. And what's even worse is I repeat it to her three times. And what's even worse, she says to me, I'm not stupid, you know, don't tell me one more time. I'm thinking, what is she like, do this on purpose? I mean, am I crazy? I mean, you know, and I'm sitting there and I'm like, explain. I said, I can't understand this. And so the next thought in my mind comes this. I says, it's 10:30 at night, 11 o'clock. I'm calling her up. Yeah. I'm calling her up. There's something wrong with you. And I was right. I was alky right. If you disagree with me, you got to die because you're so stupid. You know what I mean? I said, I'm calling her up because you know why? She can't be allowed to get away with this. No, she can't. She can't. She shouldn't be able to go to sleep without knowing what she did to me. And when I asked her for this one thing and she didn't do that. And man, I'm telling you, every bone in my body wanted to call her up and thought it was right to call her up, and I'm going to call her up. And then somewhere in the midst of this self, whatever the heck it is, self-pity bullshit, alcoholism, which could strike at any time, I had this thought. I said, you know, if I call up Vanessa, and of course I was going to say it in a nice way, Vanessa, I was going to say, Vanessa, I just thought you ought to know at 11 o'clock at night that I just wanted you to know that, you know, when I asked you to get this thing, you yelled at me the thing and everything, I just wanted you to tell me you brought the wrong coffee. I thought you should know that. And I said, but all of a sudden I started thinking, I said, you know, if I call Vanessa, knowing Vanessa, because she's a tough gal, but on the inside she's, you know, like me and like her, she's like tender. And I tell her at 10:30 at night that she bought the wrong coffee, what she's going to hear is, Vanessa, I want you to know I think you're a loser. And little girls shouldn't hear their father tell them they're losers. As a matter of fact, women should never hear a man say things like that to them. So, you know, women should be lifted up by men. So, I didn't call her. I figured, I guess what like Travis figured, I figured maybe God wants me to drink decaf, although I can't believe he would be that cruel, you know what I mean? And I didn't call her. And I would usually say at this point, as far as I know, she'll never hear about this, but she listened to one of my tapes and she heard about it. And for 2 days, she didn't talk to me. But now it's safe to tell the story. You know what I mean? And you know, that's a story. And let me tell you something. I sponsor men who haven't spoken to their daughters or brothers or mothers or fathers for 15 years because they made that phone call.
because they picked up the phone to tell them something because they weren't going to allow them to get away with it. That's the story about this disease, no matter how long. That's why you have to be eternally vigilant. That's why you have to constantly be focused on God. You have to constantly be focused on this deal and make him the central factor of your life. Because if you do that in the midst of your craziness, you'll stop thinking like yourself, and you'll start thinking like him, have his mind. You understand? It'll stop you from doing stuff like that. You know, so you can still have a family and people to talk to and stuff like that. I'm not immune from this disease. And I'm glad I'm not. It's my holy thorn. You know, if I didn't have this disease, I wouldn't have to look to God all the time. I'd look to myself. I'd be looking to the cars. I'd be looking to this. But one of the things that it does, it pushes me closer to him. So God bless you. Thank you very much.